Welcome back to Public Address Radio on Radio Live. Pink Panthers, traffic lights, blue devils. If you know what these are, the three drinks from the kids' menu at Cobb & Co. circa 1980, then you already know a few things about the history of the New Zealand restaurant. But as Perrin Rowland discovered while writing her thesis on our culinary history, dining out in New Zealand is much richer and goes back far further than those beige days of the 1970s and 80s. Perrin's fascinating new book, Dining Out, charts that history all the way back to the first settlers, and it's a real treat to read. Perrin Rowland joins us now. Well, Perrin, thank you so much for joining us. Now, firstly, explain to me why an American is writing about New Zealand restaurants.
I fell into it, actually, to be honest with you. I knew I wanted to write food history when I came to New Zealand. I knew I had something to write about how we ate and the history of that. But I didn't know about the story of restaurants. And I had a really interesting conversation with someone when I was sort of coming up with thesis topics. And she said, oh, well, you know, the restaurant has to be done. And I said, oh, I like restaurants. And so and the funny thing about
I love that
research,
you just spent 30,000 words I like restaurants.
5 years of my life, 5 a.m. writings. I know it's sort of snowballed beyond me. It becomes bigger than the subject becomes bigger than the writer. And that is this is a great example of that, because I just started at the beginning and I went back to 1840, and it wasn't until I was about halfway through it did I find out there wasn't supposed to be any story. And so I'm holding all this material going, there's a problem here. Something here. There's a story here.
Well, I got caught up in it, I've got to say. I didn't have a lot of time to read it, and I intended to flick through the whole thing, and I got stuck on those early chapters. It's a fascinating read. The biggest myth you dispel is that there were no restaurants in New Zealand before 1961, which is when the licensing laws changed,
sure.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. There's this idea that from 1917, all restaurants in New Zealand just disappeared.
But you've got restaurants going back in here as far as the 1870s and, mm-hmm. and before.
1860s, 1850s.
And far from the meat and three veg that seemed to dominate at least our perception of restaurants throughout that time, we had some amazing fare, didn't we, on offer?
Very, very French, very continental, very international.
Talk us through the development of the New Zealand restaurant briefly, and for those, you know, from 1860 through to the Depression when it all changed.
Well, the restaurant was imported like colonialism. So with colonial arrivals, they brought concepts of the restaurant with them. So there was real no development like there was in France, because from France, the restaurant was initially a soup, and then it developed into this very complicated business. So when the restaurant came to New Zealand, it came as the business. The historical record in New Zealand tends to start around 1840, but I wouldn't be surprised to find documents in Russell that have restaurants in the 1830s. This was really unusual because there weren't that many restaurants outside of Paris before the sort of late 19th century. So this is showing that actually New Zealand is extraordinarily modern and well connected. That concept continues up into the 20th century. People imported really sophisticated equipment to run these restaurants. They had really sophisticated stoves, champagne glasses, butter dishes, heavy silverware, fine china, linen. To run a restaurant, you need more than just customers. You need, you know, paper printers, candlestick makers, launderers, butchers. I mean, you need a whole industry behind you in order to set this up. So restaurants are really a sign of an urban, a level of urban development in New Zealand. Where they really seem to happen immediately is in Auckland and Dunedin, because of the gold rush in Dunedin, and there was a massive buildup there. So you've got hundreds of restaurants that are really serving an itinerant population. Now, the itinerant population aren't just single poor guys. There's all sorts of class levels for these travelers. So in Dunedin, you see really inexpensive restaurants, these sort of penny dinners, shilling dinners shilling was actually probably really expensive back then, but, you know, half penny. And then you see these more fancy, exclusive restaurants that are competing with the more sophisticated, you know, more exclusive clubs in Dunedin, like the Fernleaf Club. And then up in Auckland and Wellington, and like as you go into the later 19th century, as urban development grows, you see restaurants grow with them.
If the restaurant scene existed to this extent, why was this all lost? Why is it a myth that they didn't exist?
They were very commonplace. This wasn't something that you needed to write home about, even though certain people did. I found some great letters back amongst the colonials about how they spent their lunch days and things like that. But when you opened up the newspaper, for example, all you would see is, you know, a civil meal for convenient passengers, or us, you know, describing a little bit of what was going on, and a Britisher experience at the Chip King of San Francisco here in Greymouth. I mean, these are the sorts of things that you find in the newspapers.
What I was fascinated to read was also, I mean, firstly, that the history of the restaurant didn't go back that far anywhere in the world. I would have thought that, like prostitution, there were restaurants around since, you know, the age of time, but it's a relatively modern concept.
The way we understand it is a very modern concept.
And by the time we got to around about 1910, thereabouts,
okay.
On the other hand, the whole thing had gone well to the other end of the street.
We had gilded
cages. You know, diners would dine in gilded cages with swans floating around and things like this. I mean, you know, like amazing stuff. Did that happen in New Zealand as well?
Not to that extent. I mean, the New Zealanders probably don't have the sort of elaborateness that New Yorkers have. And that has to do with funds and a sense of temperament as well as...
We didn't have Tiffany to make us...
Exactly. And you know, you also didn't have the railroad boom where, you know, they were eating diamonds off the soles of their shoes sorts of things. but that being said, there were extraordinary parties here in New Zealand at the turn of the century. You have... there's a great place in Wellington in 1890 called the Trocadero, and he used to hold just the most wild parties.
Now, look, we're rapidly running out of time, and I can see that we're getting to the point where we're at 1910 now. So let's whip through what happened in the Depression. There was the Wowsers that were trying to stop people drinking, the temperance movement, all this sort of stuff, prohibition. Did that effectively shut down restaurants for 50 years?
Quite the opposite. It probably resulted in more restaurants, because what had happened is it divided the wets from the drives, and so the wets needed a place to dine out and sort of smuggle booze under their shirts and their sleeves and in their handbags, and the dries needed to sort of eat out away from everybody else's drinking. So you saw the development of vegetarian restaurants, all these fads, these vegetarian restaurants, eating raw fruit diets, muscle men diet places, as well as dainty tea rooms. Dainty food was very popular. And these were real restaurants. It's hard to conceive now that a tea room is a restaurant, but they were thought of and described and shared as restaurants.
I was going to say, it's not hard to conceive of the fact they might have raw food restaurants and dainty food restaurants.
I know, it's like LA.
Like that's just like now, isn't it? Really?
Yeah. Little molecular gastronomy in the 1930s.
At what point did we get this reputation for the stodgy, the Cobb & Co. kind of meat and three veg, boring meal? When did that come around?
It was a transnational trend. Everybody's food in the 1950s sucked. Right. Nobody liked it.
We didn't seem to change that until about the 1980s?
Well, you start pockets of it in the 60s because you have the Nouvelle Cuisine Revolution in France in the late 1950s, started by Fernand Pointe and then sort of celebrated by Paul Bocuse and the Trois Gras brothers and all these sorts of people. And they really celebrate the idea of moving away from a Escoffier and away from food that doesn't make sense. So Escoffier is all about everybody serving the same food all the time, which is why everybody has the meat and three veg. That's an Escoffier principle that's been passed out. It's sort of been diluted as it moves farther and farther away from France. Same with Nouvelle Cuisine, which is why you get a tofu and a pamarillo slice and some coulis. But Nouvelle Cuisine is all about the trying of the new and trying new things and putting new things together and using food that's within your own geographical location. It's the birth of the locavore moment. And so that's what changed everybody's diets, because instead of trying to be something that they weren't, they're trying to be everything that they were.
It's definitely something that everyone's got an interest in. I was sitting on the plane and I could see out of the corner of my eyes.
Buy the book.
I was sitting out of the corner of my eye. The woman next to me was looking as I was flicking through. So I was doing it for her. I was looking past the old Cobb & Co. pictures and the old Chinese restaurant, things like that. And I could see her. And at the end, she said, "Excuse me, what's that book?" So hopefully that bodes well for it.
That book is Dining Out by Perrin Rolland, and it's available on all good booksellers near you.
It's a lovely book. It's got, as we were saying, it's got reproductions of the menus and things like that. And there was one little quote that I loved in there. Can you remember what it was? Oh, here we go. Mixing champagne and cocktails in cabaret cuddle cubicles, respectable restaurant by day, the Dixieland morphed into a temple of jazz at night for Auckland's frivolous flappers and effeminate nincompoops. That's from the New Zealand Truth, 1926. Sounds like they haven't changed much over the years.
No, they're still censoring, aren't they? And we're still having a good time despite them, aren't we?
There really was a sense that the restaurants, going to a restaurant back then was a dangerous thing to do, wasn't it? And does that still exist? Have we lost that?
I hope not, because we're about to go into the Rugby World Cup, where the whole idea of having fun and a good time has to become a New Zealand pastime. And so, let's hope we're all having a good time as New Zealanders.
New Zealanders are very well aware of the cultural cringe, and you've said we've got that in terms of our culinary history. Do you think this book dispels that cultural cringe, or will dispel that cultural cringe?
I would love it to. I've seen reviews still kind of go out saying, great book, tells you a lot about it. It's a shame we didn't have restaurants before 1960. And you just sort of go, oh. The move away from the hotel dining room is really hard, and the idea of the hotel dining room is really specific. And the reality is that there were some great hotel restaurants, but there were a lot of restaurants outside of that system that were really feeding New Zealanders a unique experience. And I think that's something we should all celebrate.
And Perrin's book, Dining Out, A History of the Restaurant in New Zealand, is available in all good bookstores. After the break, we celebrate the Black Ferns victory and talk about the role of women's rugby in New Zealand, and we head to the Silver Scrolls.